Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello everybody, my name is Piervito Lopriore. I'm a neurologist and a PhD student in translational medicine in Pisa. In today's episode, we will talk about red flags of treatable mitochondrial disorders. Mitochondrial disorders are the most frequent genetic metabolic disorders in humans and pathogenic variants in all 37 mitochondrial DNA genes and in more than 400 nuclear DNA genes have been associated with defects of the oxidative phosphorylations, which is the hallmark of these diseases. What makes mitochondrial diseases particularly challenging is their extreme clinical heterogeneity because they can present at any age and involve virtually any organ. For neurologists, the key challenge is not only recognizing the wide spectrum of clinical manifestations affecting both the central and the peripheral nervous system, but also identifying the red flags that should raise the suspicion for a mitochondrial etiology, especially in cases where targeted treatments are available. In this episode, we will discuss how to recognize treatable mitochondrial disorders in the daily neurological practice. We will explore the clinical clues that should prompt further investigations, and we will also delve into the current therapeutic strategies with a particular focus on the emerging disease-modifying approaches. And we will also look ahead for the future of mitochondrial medicine, including treatment and initiatives that are currently under development. I'm delighted to be joined today by two internationally recognized experts in the fields. Our first guest is Professor Michelangelo Mancuso, Professor of Neurology at the University of Pisa, and Professor Chiara Lamorgia, leading expert in the field of mitochondrial medicine. Professor Mancuso, Professor Lamorgia, welcome to the EAN Cast, and thank you very much for joining us today. My first question is to Professor Mancuso. Let us set optic neuropathies aside for the moment. Could you give us an overview of the main treatable mitochondrial diseases? Which clinical phenotypes and genetic defects should neurologists be particularly aware of? And what are the key elements that help us recognize those conditions in the daily clinical practice?
Thank you, Piervito. First of all, I'm very happy to join this episode. So, as you were introducing, we now have new developments in the field of mitochondrial medicine, and very recently, beside the idepenone treatment that will be covered by Chiara, but in the very recent, I would say months, but definitely very few years, we now have treatment for at least three different primary mitochondrial diseases. I'm trying to cover a little bit these three disorders, giving you a few red flags to how to recognize these diseases, and I will comment briefly on the new therapeutic strategies. So first of all, the first one that I want to touch is the Friedreich ataxia, an autosomal recessive neurodegenerative disease that is caused by mutations in the frataxin gene, which is a mitochondrial protein. And when we have frataxin deficiency, we have mitochondrial dysfunction, oxidative stress, and the development of a clinical phenotype that usually the typical onset is in childhood or adolescence, even though we now know that we may have onset of Friedreich ataxia also later during disease course, during the life. So how do we recognize Friedreich ataxia? So first of all, the main clinical features are, of course, neurological, because the patient develops progressive gait and limb ataxia with dysarthria and the loss of proprioception and vibration sense and areflexia. But together with this neurological clinical feature, we also have musculoskeletal and orthopedic features like the pes cavus, scoliosis, but also extra neurological involvements, and mainly cardiac with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, diabetes mellitus, and most of the patient will also develop optic atrophy and sensory neural hearing loss. So how can we recognize this disease? Usually we have children or adolescents with a progressive gait ataxia associated with cardiomyopathy, and mainly also with pes cavus, scoliosis, and during the neurological examination, we observe absent deep tendon reflexes. So we should definitely explore this disease because we now have the treatment, which is the Skyclarys, is omaveloxolone, the molecule which is was very recently approved in Europe. And the mechanism of action is of omaveloxolone is improving mitochondrial function, acting on the NRF signaling, but also fighting oxidative stress. So it's a new therapy which is able to, I mean, it's a symptomatic treatment. It's not really disease modifying. What we observe using the omaveloxolone in patients with Friedreich ataxia, we have an improvement, a decline on the either SARA or FARS rating scale. So the severity of the disease progresses slower, and in some patients, we also have an improvement on the clinical scale. So it's definitely a good novelty in the field. The other important disease that I want to mention is the TK2 deficiency. It's an ultra-rare autosomal recessive, again, a mitochondrial disease. And we have pathogenic variants in this TK2 gene, which is an important enzyme playing a role into the mitochondrion, leading when we have a deficiency in this gene, we have mitochondrial DNA depletion or multiple deletion that mainly affect the skeletal muscle. The first observation of TK2 deficiency was really in kids, in very young children, but we now know that the spectrum range from infantile myopathy that can mimic also SMA to slowly progressive adult disease that can mimic limb girdle muscle dystrophy or also FSHD. So what we observe in this patient typically is a progressive myopathy, which most of the time start in the proximal muscle and then involving the distal muscles associated with hypotonia. We have a very clear progressive respiratory muscle weakness with nocturnal hypoventilation in these patients. Very rarely we have CNS involvement, but we may have CNS involvement. What makes this group of mitochondrial disease unique is that most of the time we observe in the blood an increase not only of lactate, but also of CK, which is quite unique situation in mitochondrial medicine. So when we have a patient with muscle weakness, respiratory failure, and we do document an increment of lactate and CK, we should think about TK2 deficiency. Also because now, very recently, EMA approved the treatment, which is called the KGB, is a combination of two pyrimidine and nucleoside. And basically, you can provide this drug orally, so it's quite the impact of this drug is quite dramatic, it's amazing. So we must recognize this patient. The last disease, which is extremely rare, that I want to discuss briefly, is the Bard syndrome, is X-linked recessive mitochondrial disorder. And we have a mutation in a gene, a TAX gene, which disrupts the cardiolipin remodeling into the mitochondrial membranes. Most of these patients are kids with a severe cardiac involvement, with severe cardiomyopathy and also ventricular arrhythmia associated with frequently neutropenia, skeletal myopathy, and also typically they have methylglutaconic aciduria that can be a nice red flag to investigate. So these are kids with cardiomyopathy, mainly dilated cardiomyopathy, with most of the time neutropenia and methylglutathionic aciduria. And in this disease, we have in the States for now this new molecule recently approved, elamipretide, which is a short peptide that gets into the mitochondria and is able to bind cardiolipin and restore mitochondrial membrane structure. So it is not super efficient drug in Bart syndrome, but definitely it works. It helps these children mainly for the cardiomyopathy and the fatigue associated to the disease. So these are the three main diseases where we now have treatment and we should recognize.
Thank you, Professor Mancuso, for the wonderful overview. So now focusing on the Leber hereditary optic neuropathy, or LHON, which represent one of the most paradigmatic examples of the treatable mitochondrial disorders. So how can clinicians recognize LHON, especially in its early stages? And what are the current therapeutic options, Professor Lamorgia?
Thank you very much, Piervito, for your question. And I'm very happy to be part of this episode. So LHON is a hereditary optic neuropathy for which the genetic landscape is increasingly growing. We knew that LHON is due to mtDNA variants. This is the classical form of LHON. But in the recent years, there are also growing evidences showing that there are also nuclear genes causing recessive forms of LHON. And clinicians should be aware also of these more rare forms of LHON. So the classical one is inherited along the maternal line because it's due to mtDNA variants. For the other forms, we should expect different genetic bases and transmission, of course. In terms of clinical presentation, this is a very specific disease, and both ophthalmologists and neurologists should be aware of the typical and specific features of this disease. This is disease causing an acute, subacute loss of central vision without pain at eye movements. This is a differential between LHON and inflammatory optic neuritis, for example, and there is no spontaneous visual recovery. In terms of fundus appearance, there are very specific features of this disease, which is the occurrence of microangiopathy, telangiectatic changes, but also pseudoedema of the optic nerve fibers around the optic disc. And these are all specific features of LHON. Also, can be seen hyperemic feature of the optic disc. A tool which is very important for supporting the diagnosis in the very early stage of the disease is OCT, which is an instrumental exam that is now available also for neurologists. So it's very important to know the potential use of this instrumental exam, because OCT is showing in the very early stage of LHON some specific feature, which is an early and transient thickening of the retinal nerve fiber layer around the optic disc, which is following always the same order. So you can observe a temporal inferior superior nasal thickening, and then the same order you have an atrophy of the same fibers in the same order. Moreover, the segmentation of single retinal layers allows to see a very early ganglion cell layer defect, which is a very early sign of this disease, a difference, for example, with optic neuritis. So there are some clinical and instrumental and funduscopic clues that helps the clinician in making the diagnosis. Visual fields typically show a central scotoma, which is also typical for those diseases affecting the papillomacular bundle. In terms of therapeutic option, there is an approved therapy for LHON, which is Idebenone, which is the only approved therapy for this disease at the moment. And this molecule allows to bypass the complex 1 defect, which is the biochemical feature of the disease, since mtDNA variants are all affecting complex 1. Idebenone is effective in this disease in its reduced forms, because it's transformed to idebenol, to this enzyme, which is called NQOA, which is very important to know that polymorphic variants affecting this enzyme can affect also the response to therapy. So what is emerged in the last years is that polymorphic variants affecting this enzyme can impact on idebenone efficacy. And this is very relevant, especially for the 340 mutation, which is one of the three most common LHON mutations. In terms of other therapeutic options, there are also clinical trials have been conducted with gene therapy just for the 11778 mutation, which is the most common LHON mutation. And this therapeutic strategy was not approved yet. In terms of comparison between treatments, a recent meta-analysis showed that gene therapy was superior to the idebenone itself, but there are still some missing data and also association between idebenone and gene therapy in terms of better outcome is not still clear.
Thank you, Professor Lamorgia, for this clear overview. So I want to stress here the LHON and the optic neuropathy team. So looking ahead, what can we expect in the near and medium term future for LHON and for the other mitochondrial optic neuropathies? I'm thinking, for example, or autosomal dominant optic atrophy. Are there any new therapies on the horizon? Are there any ongoing or upcoming clinical trials that clinicians should be aware of?
Well, there is a lot of ongoing research on LHON, and there are other therapeutic approach that I would define under development because they are still at the stage of preclinical studies. One of these approaches, which is very promising, is gene editing for correcting MMT DNA variants, especially targeting the retinal ganglion cells, of course, because this is a disease affecting retinal ganglion cells. The aim of this approach is establishing an heteroplasmic state in variants, which usually are homoplasmic. This is typical for LHON variants. On the same line, there is a big effort also in testing the possibility of transplanting wild-type mitochondria. And also there are some developing approaches aimed at delivering genetic material or drugs targeting specifically retinal ganglion cells, which are the tissue which is affected by this disease. However, these, as I said, are mostly preclinical studies, so not at the stage of human clinical trials. Concerning OPA1-related dominant optic atrophy, this is a disease different from LHON because this is a disease usually starting in childhood, very insidious, still characterized by selective loss of retinal ganglion cells and typically characterized by a central scotoma. But the disease course is not acute, subacute, as I was describing for LHON. In terms of genetic of therapeutic options, idebenone is not approved for this disease, even though there is a complex one defect even for OPA1 dominant optic atrophy. So there is a rationale for using idebenone even for OPA1 DOA. In terms of gene therapy approaches, there are essentially three possible approaches. One is the use of ASO, targeting mainly haplosufficient variants of OPA1. And this is an approach which is closer to the stage of a clinical trial, which is expected for this year, phase one clinical trial. Another potential approach, which is actually amenable for dominant negative variants, is the use of RNA transplanting approaches. And finally, they use the classical CRISPR-Cas9 technology for gene editing. This is the overall scenario, even for OPA1 DOA.
Thank you, Professor Lamorgia. To conclude, the last question to Professor Mancuso. Could you provide a broader overview of the most relevant ongoing clinical trials in mitochondrial diseases, as well as also the key international initiatives or the collaborative efforts that are shaping the current clinical practice and also the future research in the field of mitochondrial medicine?
Okay, Piervito, this is a huge amount of information you want to have from me in a few minutes. So as I was saying at the very beginning, mitochondrial medicine is really in a special moment of its life because we are facing a new era with a lot of pharma interest in this not so rare group of disorders. So definitely, we already have a lot of ongoing clinical trials that are either phase one or phase two A to B. I would say we have around 15 clinical trials with new molecules under investigation. Most of them are already in phase two. So the possibilities in order to overcome the OXPHOS defect are multiple because, you know, the complexity of the biochemical pathways into the mitochondria need to have different possible approaches. We can try to improve mitochondrial biogenesis, for instance, with some molecules. We can try to fight oxidative stress. We may finally reach gene editing also in the mitochondria, where we cannot apply the CRISPR-Cas technology for multiple reasons, but we now have different gene editing approaches that can be delivered into the mitochondria. We have additional molecules that are under investigation trying to improve also mitochondrial biogenesis, but from upstream, acting on the PGC1-alpha pathway, for instance. So there are really a lot of ongoing clinical trials. And at the same time, what is becoming more and more important now that we have the industry manifesting interest in mitochondrial medicine, we now really need to collaborate, right? The stakeholders must collaborate because we need to have multiple patients with the same phenotype. And sometimes these diseases are extremely rare. Think about TK2 deficiency of Barth syndrome. This is the reason why in the past 20 years, a lot of international cooperation is ongoing. We now have a European registry, for instance, for mitochondrial diseases, which is called Genomit. And we have a very strong involvement also the European Reference Network, collaborating with scientists and also with the European Academy of Neurology, not only to increase the awareness of these very important disorders, but also, you know, putting money to help the experts to build consensus statement or guidelines, documents that can be delivered to the patients, to the clinicians, to, you know, I try to give good advice on how to recognize, how to diagnose, how to manage all these different mitochondrial diseases. So it's a very nice moment for mitochondrial medicine, and we are very confident that within 5-10 years, more molecules will be available in the market, and hopefully soon also gene therapy for our patients.
Thank you. So as we wrap up today's episodes, let's briefly summarize some key points. So mitochondrial diseases are complex. As Professor Mancuso was saying, these disorders are multi-system disorders. An increasing number of mitochondrial diseases are now treatable or at least modifiable when recognized early. So early diagnosis relies on spotting the key red flags, which are, for example, the multi-organ involvement, the clear family history, some typical neuromuscular patterns, or also characteristic lab or imaging findings. LHON, as Professor Lamorgia was saying, is a clear example because prompt recognitions and edebenone, together with emerging also gene therapies, show how targeted treatment can change the trajectory of the disease. And behind LHON, there are other disorders such as Friedreich ataxia, Barth syndrome, and TK2 deficiency, and also new trials and new therapies, including, for example, MTDA maintenance disorders, which are rapidly expanding options for mitochondrial patients. Above all, the progress in this field is a team effort, as Professor Mancuso was saying. So we need multidisciplinary care, we need a referral to expert centers, participation in registries, international consensus initiatives, a partnership with industry, which are essential to improve the diagnosis, the management, and ultimately the lives of people with mitochondrial disorders. I would like to sincerely thank my guests for sharing their expertise and insights with us today. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on EANCast Weekly Neurology. We hope this episode inspires curiosity in this exciting field. Until next time, goodbye, and thank you for listening.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.